American Psycho is like the gayest book ever written. And I said, it is pretty gay because Patrick Bateman's so fucking gay.
In the 1980s and 90s, novelist Bret Easton Ellis captured more fully than anyone the excitement and ennui of a wealthy and smug America that was stumbling without knowing it into a new century filled with terror, disruption, and generalized hostility. In the book and movie versions of Less Than Zero, The Rules of Attraction and American Psycho, Ellis dissected what happens to a society in which depth of feeling becomes synonymous with failure to thrive. In this century, Ellis is back in his hometown of Los Angeles, writing and producing movies with the likes of Lindsay Lohan and porn star James Dean, whose shambled personal lives might as well have been scripted by Ellis in one of his most darkly comic moments. He's also putting out one of the most engaging and insightful podcasts available on Patreon, talking with everyone from Kanye West to Rose McGowan to veteran writer-director Walter Hill about the ways in which the entertainment industry is built upon an unstable foundation of economic, sexual, and political hypocrisy.
Corporate culture is the reason why James got fired. Not Mike Cernovich and not like, no. Yeah. It is corporate culture.
Reason talked with Ellis in his L.A. condo about the ways in which Hollywood is failing to come to terms with ever-changing methods of production and distribution, what he sees as the excesses of the Me Too movement, and our rapidly changing online public discourse.
I think the Mark Duplass apology is one of the most depressing things that happened this year. How can someone who you really like and you had a good time with, and he's one of the good ones over there, whatever Mark Duplass said, 48 hours later be a racist, homophobic, piece of shit, jerk?
We'll also get to the undeniable appeal of Donald Trump, not just to small town America, but to denizens of Beverly Hills. And we'll talk about the aesthetic and political implications of a world in which American movies are increasingly made with an eye towards pleasing audiences and governments in foreign countries.
You've been podcasting since about 2013 or so. Your most recent podcast coming back after a brief hiatus is on Patreon.
Yes.
Tell me, what is the goal of the podcast and what are you hoping to do with it?
Well, the goal is, first of all, to have fun. There's no reason to do this without having fun and being engaged by what I'm talking about. I would hate to have the podcast be like a job that I have to do. And so we were away for about a year. We were at Podcast One, and there was a bit of a problem with advertising. Podcast One really demanded advertising because, of course, that's how they make money, and that's how the podcast would make money. I was having a problem with advertisers. A lot of advertisers weren't happy about how I was reading the ads, for example, and they wondered why I wasn't more enthusiastic. And I could get very enthusiastic about movies I've seen, but I just relayed all of the information in the ad in a very kind of monotone.
So, like, Dulco Lax is not, you're not going to get
a Dollar Shave Club. Yeah. You know,
these are good products.
They are good products. And I thought I was giving them a kind of a classy patina by not like overdoing it like Adam Carolla or whoever. And I like Adam Carolla, but he knows how to sell those.
Right.
He is a pro at that. I was not a pro at it. And I also got a lot of flack in social media, like Bret Easton Ellis is reading something for only nuts, you know, the new nut mix, that is. And, you know, I felt Podcast One had been great to me in terms of just giving me total freedom to do whatever I wanted. And I felt I owed them the ads. The ads just weren't working. They weren't working for my producer. They weren't working for me. We looked around for about a year and we landed on Patreon and we decided we'd do that and see if we could also make some money off the podcast. I don't think there's anything wrong at all with charging $1.50 for 90 to 100 minutes worth of content. We have pushback on that, definitely.
But you do have pushback on it?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of complaints. A lot of people don't like it. But at the same time, I feel that there's this rhythm. We only do it every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But we do produce it. You know, it's not just me on the mic with some random person and we're talking about what happened yesterday or what's going on in the news. It's a culturally minded podcast about a wide array of subjects and not particularly political at all. It's really mostly about culture. A film culture, TV culture, and where it's going. And so the notion of the podcast is to be a reflection of whatever's on my mind in those moments. It could be a review of a film. It could be a very long review of a film. It could be talking about the latest TV season. And occasionally I'll dip my toe into the hypocrisies of Hollywood and I will dip my toe, not into politics, not because I'm honestly not that interested in politics, but in terms of the hypocrisies of the media, the hypocrisies of Hollywood, and how that bounces off against politics, I will occasionally do a show like that that is often ridiculously controversial for some reason among my audience. But the podcast is, I noticed when I was writing long form articles that people weren't really reading the whole article. They were reading like the pull quotes, they were reading the first paragraph, maybe skimming it. And that was very new to me about 2013, 2014. I thought, oh, this is really interesting. People are not reading the whole thing because they see stuff on message boards about, why didn't Ellis say this? Why is he going on? And if you just went four paragraphs down, whatever. But I was shocked to find out that people would listen to an hour-long podcast or a two-hour-long podcast
and,
with no problems.
Like you were saying, I mean, the most recent ones, I mean, it's almost, it could be 15 or 20 minutes of you essentially
just
reading
talking,
an essay or talking through a review of a movie or things like that.
That is. And we also edit the podcast. We produce it. We add music cues. My editor on it is terrific, really speeds it up, gives it a pace. There's no lags. There's no long pause or anything like that. So it is kind of a production. And we want to make it as listenable as possible. And we also want them to be kind of a library of podcasts that you can go back and listen to. If it's about a filmmaker you want to have a deep dive with, I did a very long one with Walter Hill that a lot of people reference, that a lot of people like.
Explain who Walter Hill is.
Walter Hill is.
Who don't know? I do. I was going to say for these damn millennials who come up with for a fair amount of grief in your regular conversation.
They do, but I also live with one, and I've been living with one for 8 years, so I feel that grief is earned, and I feel that I can, with some degree
and
of
you are,
sanity, say
what,
that.
You're the last year of the baby boom or the very start of Gen X?
Depending on what chart you see, I'm one or the other.
Yeah.
But I've always identified with Gen X and not the baby boomers. But Walter Hill was a kind of, I would say now, though it didn't seem like it then, a kind of vanguard member of the new Hollywood. Not as famous as Scorsese or Spielberg or De Palma or Altman, but he was a journeyman, a studio filmmaker who made studio films, but in a very personal, idiosyncratic way. He put a stamp on these studio movies that are undeniably Walter Hill.
A true auteur in the original idea of that theory that you're given material, but somehow you make it your own under many constraints.
That was the 70s.
Yeah.
That was basically the 70s.
And so, I always think of he's kind of like the half-brother, the stepson of Don Siegel, somebody like that.
Yes, exactly. But he never really made giant personal movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind or The Godfather or Taxi Driver, whatever the great movies of the 70s were, that really were a distillation of that filmmaker's sensibility and was a continuum of everything that they did. Walter Hill kind of jumped around in genres, and he made movies as distinct from each other as the Driver. Who remembers The Driver? But I think he really came into commercial success with The Warriors, that gang picture that came out in 1979. And then he made 48 Hours, and he made a movie called Southern Comfort, and made a very good Western called The Long Riders. He's in his 70s. He had a movie out called The Assignment. And he was in town, he lives in town, but he was making the rounds of all the podcasts. And I realized I was going to be the last one he was doing. And I was listening to some of the podcasts that he was appearing on, and I just felt that they weren't doing a deep enough dive. I mean, Marc Maron would ask a question like, oh, you're quite the stylist, aren't you? And it was like, where do you go with that kind of question? And again, I mean, I like Marc Maron. I've been on his show, but he basically has your Wikipedia page open in his garage while he's, you know, talking to you. And I don't blame him. If you're doing two major interviews a week, how do you keep up? And he's also genuinely a fan. So you can't really slam him for that in a way. But it was frustrating to hear. So I was able to do like a 2-hour thing with Walter Hill. And, you know, that's kind of gratifying. My favorite interviews that I did were really with old Hollywood directors, whether it's Peter Bogdanovich, Paul Schrader.
And you collaborated with Schrader.
Did collaborate with Schrader, yeah.
Will you ever collaborate with him again?
No, yeah. I won't. I'll have dinner with him again, but I don't know if I'll collaborate with him
but
again.
But he's picking up the check or it's split down the middle.
I don't think Schrader's ever picked up the check. No, but never.
What is it about these older Hollywood directors that you find so interesting.
Well, but I also have had young Hollywood
right.
directors.
No, I understand
so,
that.
So Tarantino's been yeah. on, Sean Baker, you know, a lot of other young directors have been on. But that still, to me, is the most interesting decade in American film. I'm not saying it's necessarily the best. I mean, I am now on an old movie kick in mm-hmm. terms of the 30s, 40s, 50s. I really do think that maybe that kind of old school craftsmanship might now be to me the true art of making a film, whether it's Lubitsch or whoever, compared to, I mean, because a lot of crap was made in the 70s too. Let's not get our heads, you know, all out, you know.
We might fight crazy. About this, but what's a crap movie from the 70s? Race with the Devil?
You know what? I loved that movie as a kid. I saw it many times. I'm always yeah. tempted to turn it on when I come across yeah. it on Apple. What is a crap movie of the 70s? I mean, I don't know.
Would you consider a movie like Jaws to be a crap movie, regardless of its cultural impact?
Well, interestingly...
Or Close Encounters. It's a infantile movie, don't you
but
think?
Jaws and Close Encounters are also intensely personal new Hollywood movies.
Right.
And what made Jaws, and then, of course, Star Wars, have such an impact was that they were essentially B-movie pictures made on an A-level with money,
yeah,
budget,
yeah.
money, and
backing.
But also a sensibility. They took them very, very seriously. I don't think there'd been a movie like Jaws that had taken itself so seriously on such a grand scale, which is part of the excitement of that movie. And I have to say, I think Close Encounters is one of the great achievements of 70s filmmaking because it's such a personal movie, but it's also an epic UFO film. It's also a conspiracy theory movie. It's about the 70s. It's about Watergate. It's about mm-hmm. boomer discontent.
Right.
It's about the me generation, you know, embodied by Roy Neary, the character that Richard Dreyfuss plays. So on one level, and it was remarkable watching the movie in its 40th re-release last fall, how beautiful it was, how the studio let Spielberg do really pretty much whatever he wanted. And he has this amazing looking movie that has a propulsion, this kind of like very gripping sci-fi plot going on. And yet you can also just see how much it tapped into the moment. And also really how kind of uncompromising it was in some of its family scenes, which Spielberg had cut out in 1981. Really harrowing fight scenes between Terry Garr and Richard Dreyfuss, and he leaves the family. I mean, he just leaves the family and goes up into the spaceship. And I really don't know if you could do that now without panic.
How does your millennial roommate, does he look at Close Encounters and he's like, this is fucking worse than a silent movie? I guess buried beneath that is, do you find the 70s, you know, the long 70s in cinema, that decade, do you find it endlessly fascinating? Because it also just happens to correspond with your childhood and adolescence.
Of course it does, because I meet so many younger filmmakers who rhapsodize about the 90s, the independent movement of the 90s, which, sure, was quite exciting to a degree, but it definitely has everything to do with when you came of age. Mm-hmm. But I also, I still think, you're talking about grand movies made in the 70s on a very lavish scale that are very personal, made by the studios. The indie movement of the 90s was almost a DIY affair. It wasn't made on such a grand scale. It was independent cinema. I mean, mm-hmm. the 70s was studio movie backing, and you can't imagine, you know, a studio, even in the 90s, making A Clockwork Orange or A Taxi Driver or whatever. So, you know, it's... I actually showed him a lot of movies when we first started living together, because he really didn't have a framework for that time. And I have to say, he was pretty thrilled by what I was showing him, whether it was The Last Picture Show or Dog Day Afternoon or Carrie or a lot of movies, highlights, from that era. The Godfather, for example, which he'd never... And so he was really thrilled, and he couldn't believe that movies had been made like that back then. But he also was raised in a particular time where movies were the weekend. Movies were What is the number one movie this weekend? What are we all going to see? And that is kind of how he experienced movies, that moment when everything changed and everyone became obsessed with box office, which had actually happened in the 80s. But so he was kind of amazed that American film was kind of like an art form in a very distinct way from how and on a grand scale compared to how movies are made now and how they're watched.
You're from L.A., you moved back to L.A. Do you feel like film is still the paradigmatic American art form? Is it as important as it was, say, in the 70s or 80s? Has it been supplanted by television? Clearly novels, which is or writing, which is where you got your start, that seems to, I mean, it persists, but it doesn't seem to be as important as movies or TV or music.
The novel as a way of imparting information, the novel in terms of a novel comes out and you're introduced to a world you've known nothing about. It's much talked about. It's like almost like a news bulletin from the front. That kind of novel doesn't really exist anymore because you can find out whatever you want, whenever you want, via the internet. And a novel isn't, the uses of the novel are different than they once were. And I don't think people go to novels that way. I mean, Less Than Zero is a classic example. Less Than Zero was sort of seen as this document about what kids are up to today, right, as much as it was a novel. And certainly there were novels that would come out.
My mother, who I've never, as far as I know, never read a novel, but she read something about that book in 1985 or 86, mm-hmm. shortly after it came out. And she was like, don't go to any of those parties where they show snuff movies.
Right. Right.
And I was like, okay, Mom.
Yeah.
Although I think if you show up and they're showing one, it's too late. Right.
It's over. Yeah. You know, it's completely over. But I do think that novels don't work that way anymore. Films, certainly, their place in the culture has diminished greatly in terms of being at the center of a conversation, being the center of the conversation for the kind of, for the cultural intelligentsia.
So you're saying like Rampage or, you know, the next Fast and Furious movie isn't going to play the same role in America as The Godfather did, or is coming home.
When you put it that way, it sounds rather naive. I mean, but yes, of course it is. Yeah. But still, there are cinephiles, and still there are believers. You can find them everywhere from Quentin Tarantino to Christopher Nolan to Scorsese. And there are more film festivals than ever. There's more film critics than there have ever been. There is more attention placed on movies in a way that we've never seen before. It's just that the movies aren't very good. And they just don't, for the most part, they're not being made with the kind of care and expense that many of them need. I see movies all the time that I realize, oh, they couldn't do that because they didn't have the money for the party. Oh, they couldn't do that. So they just have three characters throughout the entire movie. Oh, they can't show the scene where they go onto the beach or they walk to the top of the skyscraper because they didn't have the money. And I think not having the money is a huge limitation to what you can do with film. Because
but there
it's expensive.
Is a ton of money for movies. It's just the movies that are going to get that kind of nearly unlimited budget are also ones now that have to play for a global audience, which puts different constraints on what type of movie you're going to be making.
Yeah, but that movie you just talked about is only being made for the global
right.
audience. And you see it like all over the place. I mean, I saw the Mamma Mia sequel, Here We Go Again, and I couldn't believe how much attention had been paid to the global needs of the box office in terms of a kind of bland, inoffensive cleanliness in terms, and also a kind of borderline dumbness of where anybody in any language can understand exactly what's going on in every scene because of the, you know, facial expressions of the characters. And I'm sure, I mean, since 70% of the global audience is not going to be seeing this movie in their language, that's kind of what the demands
right.
are. And that's true for all the Marvel movies as well. And so what you've lost is a kind of idiom, and an idiosyncratic American idiom is gone from a certain kind of lavishly made movie. And so you are stuck with either the $250 million Marvel movies, or you're dealing with independent films that they're lucky if they can get $6 to $7 million for a high-end indie. So that's just where we are. Now, people find ways to make movies all the time. More movies than ever are being made. It's just that they're like, they just don't kind of heft to it.
Beyond the, you know, and people could argue about this. I try, I'm snobby, I like certain things, but I want to be anti-elitist in this sense of saying, yeah, certain things are going to be dumbed down. So Mamma Mia, instead of being, you know, a Bergman-esque film, it's going to be reduced to...
There's a middle.
For sure. But then there are political and ideological implications of that, too. So, like, when Matt Damon is playing a Chinese warrior on the Great Wall of China, they're going to be changing all sorts of things. I mean, for God's sake, the remake of Red Dawn couldn't have, what, North Koreans or Chinese as the villains this time or something. A character in Doctor Strange had to be changed from an ancient Tibetan wise man to Tilda Swinton.
Yes.
Does that kind of stuff trouble you, or is that just part of the, this is what happens?
Well, trouble, I mean, look, real life troubles me much more than the movies do, but since I feel invested in movies, and I always have, I guess so. That, I mean, changing certain elements in material to please the Chinese, well, morally, how does one feel about that? How does one feel about the fact that there is no longer gay representation in studio movies because they need to play globally? They need to play in Russia, they need to play in China. Mm-hmm. And if you even have a hint of gayness in a movie now, like the very innocuous gay aspect in Beauty and the Beast, the live-action remake that came out last year, it's edited, or it's rated R. It's restricted in other countries, and this is a G-rated, PG-rated movie. That is kind of troubling, but it also is indicative of the hypocrisies of Hollywood, and it's very indicative of how Hollywood thinks it's so progressive and that they are so into inclusivity and diversity and all of this stuff, but really they're into money, and they want to make money. And it's
and
the most
nothing wrong with it. I mean, you're certainly not a socialist.
Not at all.
Anti-capitalist.
No, and I totally believe it. But it is. It doesn't want to acknowledge that it is one of the most capitalistic businesses in the world. You know, it is. I mean, what it wants to put out about itself and what it really is. That is the disconnect that is bothersome to a lot of people, that a lot of people go, oh. And I think it's really happened the last 2 years where Hollywood has shown itself to be, well, transparent in terms of how people now look at it. It's trying to do all of these things to be progressive. But really, it's just tripping up over itself time and time again.
Horrible language, because that's all I can do. But it's Harvey Weinstein would make sure that no horses were hurt on the set of a Miramax movie, but he might be jerking off into the face of an actress.
Yeah, you might be thinking that.
Is this tied into the Me Too?
Well, the Me Too
movement of where Hollywood has to come to terms with the fact that it's
a casting couch.
Yeah.
That's a big casting couch, and that everyone knows it's a casting couch. I guess so to some degree. I mean, it was very interesting. There was this website briefly that appeared that had all of the women who had appeared in Miramax movies throughout the 90s who never came out and said a word. And, what do you infer from that? And does it matter? I mean, Harvey Weinstein gave an interview, I think, to Tacky Theatacropolis, where he was talking about how it was a casting couch. Doesn't everybody realize in Hollywood that there is a casting couch? There is. To a degree, there are, favors exchanged. No one talks about it explicitly. I wrote a novel about it, Imperial Bedrooms, where it became very apparent that the producer of a movie is demanding that a young actress sleep with him in order to get a part. Not uncommon, let's say it. I'm not going to say it's common. Not uncommon. Sexual favors are passed around a lot. But
and not always unwelcome either.
No. Yeah. An understanding, a quid pro quo. It's a quid pro quo. And so there's an understanding to it. Now, of course, that doesn't excuse rape, it doesn't excuse sexual assault, and it doesn't excuse blacklisting people either. Now, that's all bad news, very bad news. But it does seem, the movement seems to have gotten hysterical in a way that messes up its initial message. And I think that that is kind of a problem why so many people do not take the Me Too movement seriously, as they once did. And I talked about this on the last podcast. I've talked to a lot of women who find it embarrassing, who don't believe in it at all, who really look at it as a Hollywood thing, that it's particularly a Hollywood problem. and that many women I know do not see themselves as victims of the patriarchy. Many members, females of my family, I have female friends who just do not buy into that. You can buy into that package or you don't have to buy into it. And I think when Terry Crews became the face of Me Too, a lot of people dropped out. A lot of people just said, okay, this is absurd. I mean, if that person, if Terry Crews can go to Washington, D.C. and start talking about how he's a victim and he's been an abuse survivor because someone grabbed his junk at a party in a drunken horseplay, that's the same as Harvey Weinstein raping an actress? And I don't think so. And of course, you get attacked for logically separating the idea of an unwanted hand on an ass and then getting gang raped in a parking lot and the shit beaten out of you. Matt Damon got into a lot of trouble trying to explain the differences between what really is a problem and then what is just, you know, life.
When the story about Aziz Ansari going out on a date with someone was written up in Babe, a website.
Yeah, I remember when it came out.
The response to that was kind of like, you know, that was an unfortunate evening, but it's clear it has nothing to do with what we're talking about when it's Harvey Weinstein.
Well, it's the beginning of, that was the beginning of the end. That was the beginning of the moment when Me Too seriously had to step back and say, okay, well, she had a bad date, or okay, Terry Crews didn't want a drunken agent from William Morris to touch his dick, okay. But to equate it with that is, it means then everything. Mm-hmm. Everything is sexual assault, and then that means nothing is.
Do you think that Hollywood, oddly, because it likes to always put itself as, you know, it's at the forefront, it's the avant-garde, we are the most beautiful people, we're the richest people, the most creative, we're always at the front of things. In fact, when it comes to questions about equality in the workplace, that actually the entertainment industry is way, way, way at the back of the
pack. Oh, the bottom of the bottom, the very bottom.
I mean, other industries have kind of dealt with this or have been dealing with this because, among other reasons, there's economic pressures to do that.
Yeah, you know? Completely.
To go back a little bit to the different kind of genre or media, what is the role for you of television? A lot of people talk about this as a golden age of television, both at, you know, in traditional places like ABC, NBC, you know, broadcast networks, but also because of Amazon, Netflix, and other services. You know, I was thinking when you were talking about, you know, the novel, the social function of the novel in the 19th century, in one way, was to take a thick slice of society across the society and show how all of these different parts worked. You have shows like, it could be The Sopranos, it could be The Americans, it could be Breaking Bad. I mean, these across very different platforms performing that function. Is that where the energy is?
Oh, yeah, that is definitely where the energy is. I'm not sure the art is there yet, but the energy is there. And certainly the way the audience reacts to these series really outdoes any kind of reaction a movie can get. Certainly like a Get Out can turn into this, like, you know, media made thing. But in terms of an audience reacting in a large audience reacting to these shows, that is what those shows do. And I know a lot of people who used to be somewhat voracious readers. I was just talking to my 80-year-old aunt the other day, who really, when I was growing up, read every book, every new novel. She just doesn't do it anymore. And for her, TV series are the new novel. I can lose myself in a TV series for 13, 14 hours in a way that I used to lose myself in a book. And I think, you know, whenever I say that the novel is dead or is dying, I'm not saying that I don't like the novel. I have 20 stacked up on my nightstand. I'm constantly reading novels. I've got two going right now. But I am saying that their function in society is completely different. I'm reading the Richard Burton Diaries, the actor, a wonderful writer, an absolutely wonderful writer. And I'm now about 1969, 1970. And in every entry, he's talking about what book he or Elizabeth is reading. And they're reading everything, and they're carrying paperbacks with them on planes. They were kind of like our phones in a weird way, I'm realizing while reading this, that everyone had a novel, everyone was talking about a novel. Novels had this kind of cultural weight that they simply do not at all now have. Now, you can still enjoy them, but there is, you know, that's just something that you have to live through, I guess, in terms, the same way you have to live through the fact that movies don't matter as much in that same way. And TV series do.
In a strange way. Well, it goes back and forth, because depending on the community you're part of. for me, as somebody who grew up listening to punk and rock music, it's clear like that is no longer an idiom of the masses,
right,
in the way that hip hop and then certain subsets, because that's become so diversified now. There's a whole different. Well, let me just ask you, as somebody whose fame was first as a novelist, and you said you're not saying that you hate novels or anything like that.
I love novels.
Is it difficult to realize that that chosen, you know, medium, that genre, doesn't matter the way that it did for you or for the world 40 years ago?
It's life. It's just life. I wanted to be a filmmaker and I wanted to be a musician. I mean, I was in bands in high school. I thought I was going to be a musician. I was a songwriter. I wrote hundreds of songs. I thought that was where I was going to, that's where I was going to make my mark. But I was also always writing, and I always thought, well, the writing's going to lead to filmmaking. And yet the novel kind of happened, and I realized I had four or five more novels I wanted to write, and then I'll get those out of the way, and then I'll get to filmmaking. Music by then passed off.
Which is pretty much what you did.
It is pretty much what I did, but the problem is that movies changed, and the way of making movies changed, and it's much, much harder to make a movie. Well, to make a certain kind of movie. Look, I could go out tomorrow, one of my scripts, and try to shoot it on my iPhone, I suppose, with some kids in the neighborhood. I don't want to do that. I don't want to see that kind of movie. And the kind of movie I want to make, they're just not making anymore. So that's kind of where, you know, what I'm trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I do believe that the TV series is an incredibly valid way to tell stories long form, and to explore themes, explore character. I'm often like kind of get a little impatient with movies now that are 100 minutes long, 110 minutes long, and I think, God, this would have been so much better as a series. Now, I have
Whereas
to say,
many people are like, a two-hour movie, I'm not sitting through that.
Well, you know, a two-and-a-half-hour movie made $2 billion this year, and that's all the Marvel movies are about, you know, 150 minutes. And I'm not so sure about that. I remember going to see, don't ask me why, one of the Harry Potter movies at a matinee, and I realized, oh, God, I went to this on a Saturday, and it was sold out with kids. I was with a friend of mine, and God only knows what we looked like in the middle of this thing, this theater in Westwood. And I thought, this is going to be a nightmare. These kids are going to talk.
Can I just ask, is that where you met your millennial boyfriend?
No, but that's funny.
I know what you mean. It must have been a fantastic experience to be in a theater filled with kids watching a Harry Potter movie.
You could hear a pin drop. You could hear a pin drop. You could hear a pin drop. And I looked around and I said, my God, there's not a peep. This is a 2 hour and 20 minute movie. And it just really depends on the content. Right. And so there certainly there. But look, I got to say, I watch pilots all the time that are recommended on social media or a friend. I've never heard of most of them because there are 800 shows on. And so, you know, you kind of have to weed it out. And I turn off most of them like 10 to 15 minutes in going, there is no way this needs to be 20 hours.
Right.
And so, I mean, it just depends on the talent. The one beef I have with TV content is that it still is driven by the writer. It's still driven by the showrunner. And yet it is a visual piece of work. It is filmed. It has a camera. It has actors. It has scenes in it that you have to, like, you know, edit and shoot. And the money sometimes is there, but mostly TV still is kind of locked in the writer as the star. And I think we've got to get to a point where the director becomes as much of the star, and you can start using the camera as a character, as you do in most films. Most films, movies, use the camera as a character. And they also have the money to do that. TV economics are a little different, though, you know, Bloodline, I think, cost Netflix or whatever, whoever produced that, like, you know, $350 million to make those, you know, I think those three seasons. So money is being spent. I just don't think there's this moment where the visual is coming together with the writing to produce something cinematic.
You've been on the forefront, at least in terms of the way that you financed and kind of shot the canyons.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, moving on to Patreon and things like that, on the forefront of new kind of models.
I did a web series.
So what is the appeal of that? And do you think, will these models replace the old model, or will they constantly be supplements to a kind of larger broad-based studio-like system where most of the money and most of the talent is going.
No, they're all gone. Everything that I, they're mostly gone. And also the appeal was that it's the only way I could do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the appeal. I mean, how I have a, you know, I was asked to write and direct a web series, and it was kind of like, really, a web series? Well, it's basically an hour and 40-minute movie. That's what the season is. And it's just cut into 10 episodes. And given $1 million to do this and 14 days or whatever the shooting schedule was. And I thought, great, this is going to be a movie in a way. And so I took that. But, you know, the years and years and years of trying to get movies made is really grim. And you either get into a kind of absurdist kind of frame of mind, like thinking this is all such a joke. What's going to land? What movie? I mean, I have scripts that I've written that I cannot believe they got made, whether it's these low budget horror films or compared to passion projects of mine that, you know, seem to be getting made are 10 years in development of some kind. So the movie business is just fraught with a kind of creative peril that you have to either just like deal with.
What is your favorite text or movie? I don't know if there's a song about it, about the Hollywood process. And how soul-killing it is, or how great it is.
I don't know. A song about...
Well, I doubt there's a song about it. But, I mean, you know, The Kid Stays in the Picture, or The Player, or...
Oh, you mean...
Day of the
certainly,
Locust.
Well, you know, look, getting back to the 70s thing, I think Easy Rider's Raging Bulls by Peter Biskind is kind of a great... But that's about a very specific era. It's not really about... You know, and the era's changed so much. If you told anybody in 1977 that this is what the business was going to be, they go, you're crazy. And I remember being one of those naive people who was having conversations with two of my friends who were screenwriters in the late 90s when some movie opened that grossed like a huge amount over the weekend. And we were all kind of laughing about it. And my friend said, you know, there's going to be a time in about 20 years where studio movies are going to cost $250 million. They're going to open in 40,000 theaters across the globe. They're going to make about $1 billion in 3 weeks, and then they're going to be replaced by a new one. And we were all kind of thinking, that's so alarmist. It's not going to happen. How can that happen? Well, that is what has happened. That friend was extremely prescient. But it's constantly changing, and you're kind of constantly running after. It was changing even from the 70s into the 80s, where, you know... agencies took over because the New Hollywood failed. It ultimately failed.
And by the way, did the New Hollywood fail because of the excesses of the directors or of the people who could really make demands? Or was it something else? I mean, is it, you know, One Too Many Sorcerers by William Friedkin or Heaven's Gates, you know, flop, and then suddenly it's like, okay, you're done and we're making Top Gun times 50.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And why shouldn't it? I mean, if I was running a studio, I mean, I would also like, and I was going to lose my job because I'm letting Michael Cimino make a four-hour Western that I full of smoke and, can't even tell what's going on. But, you know, that is just the natural order of things. The idea that filmmakers felt that there was so much possibility in the medium that it made them so grandly ambitious is ultimately their downfall. I mean, that's kind of the tragedy of that era.
What do video games loom in your cultural landscape? Because when you talk about $1 billion weekend, the one genre, the one medium that can routinely do that are video game franchises. And do they factor in yet? And do you think that they either have or can achieve a kind of artistic sensibility where they replace movies or TV shows or function as novels?
They already have. They already have. Mm-hmm. My boyfriend plays them all the time. And they're grand narratives. Mm-hmm. They're beautifully produced. The imagery is often stunning. Characters that talk to each other, storylines that you can choose because they're interactive. You can play with other people. I'm too old for it. I missed the boat on that. My video games were Space Invaders and like Galaga or whatever. But it's not I'm not as adept as he is, and I'm still older, so I appreciate these older forms more than he does. But I get it. I can tell why my boyfriend would spend 10 hours on the weekend playing a video game that he was completely immersed in, co-creating it, deciding to go that way rather than this way on this play. And of course, Dunkirk seems boring to him, you know? How could he sit through a two-hour movie?
To go back to I think Christopher Nolan is one of these directors who is... Dunkirk was stunning.
I thought it was stunning, too.
And I don't mean to... Generationally beat up on millennials. They were also like, wow, that was like a totally fucking different kind of war movie, and you know, much more profound. All the reason for it. Well, to talk about what is the social function that you think video games play then for millennials? If a novel was a way of getting news, of telling like what's new in the world, or to experience a different time and place. What do video games, particularly when they're being played online, in mass participation, what are they doing?
But don't they do the same thing, more or less? I mean, I think they do the same thing as the movie or the novel does, just in different ways. I mean, when I see my boyfriend and his friends talking about a new video game and talking about it with the kind of fervor that my friends and I used to talk about a short story collection that was published in 1983, whether it was Raymond Carver or whoever,
right.
Times have changed. I mean, the sensibility has changed, and it's just the same way that my boyfriend consumes news. I mean, he doesn't trust the legacy media, so he only watches news on YouTube.
A lot of InfoWars.
All YouTube.
A lot of InfoWars.
He does not watch InfoWars. He's more the Young Turks, and he's into that side of the aisle. So,
how does that sit with you? How do you define yourself politically?
I never defined myself politically until about 2 or 3 years ago when I started following this election. I never really followed elections before. I was never interested in politics. I had friends who worked in politics. In fact, I was living with a friend who ran a gubernatorial campaign. I mean, I was involved in a relationship with one in the early 90s in Virginia. And it was such a turnoff. It was so not my scene. I was just so not interested that I always checked out. And I never saw that my books were particularly political. I never took a political stance. But something about the way this election was being covered began to become interesting to me. And I noticed that, it was partisan. And I noticed that the media had a narrative that they were building. And I thought, well, the media narrative is kind of interesting, but I don't really think it's true. And so that kind of was an awakening, watching how the media covered the election of 2016.
What was the narrative that you say the media was building?
The narrative was clicking open to the New York Times in the summer of, I believe, 2015, and the headline on the front page was about Donald Trump saying Megyn Kelly bled from whatever. And I stared at it for a very long time, and I thought, that's the top headline in the New York Times. And it was kind of a moment that I still remember when, why is this the top headline? And then I began to, I already was sensing that there was a resistance, a big resistance to Trump. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. Are they going to get away with it? Is this going to work? How is the Clinton narrative going to play itself out? Because certainly the press isn't that in love with her. And so it became this kind of fascinating story for me that really wasn't even about policy, or really wasn't even about, Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. I've never considered myself any of them. When I say independent, my boyfriend says it's a cop out. You can't be independent. What the hell? You've got to be on some side. But I genuinely am. And if you check my social media, I have nothing about politics on it. I did start having an annoyance with the narratives of each of the campaigns. And I began to see that neither one was really quite honest, but the Trump resistance in the narrative, in this media narrative, was almost shocking to me. And that's kind of when I became I would say involved in the election. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that I had any,
You didn't vote for Trump?
I did not vote,
You didn't vote at all?
I did not vote at all. I live in California. I mean, what am I going to do? I mean, this whole idea of, well, you've got to vote, it's a symbol of something or whatever. It's very hard to make that symbol mean anything when you're living in Beverly Hills, or when you're living in West Hollywood, when you're living in California. It's just like, whatever. This is like an overwhelmingly lunatic blue state.
Do you worry, and as somebody who, the one thing that was great about 70s cinema is also one of the great things about the 70s America is everything was apocalyptic. The world,
yes.
The second coming of Jesus literally was about to happen, or the Cold War was about to become a thermonuclear disaster. overpopulation, despoilation of the environment, you name it, the world was about to end.
Yes.
Do you worry that we are entering a new era of apocalypticism?
My mother finds all of this alarmist rhetoric ridiculous. She's 75, and she talks, you really want to know about a worrisome time? Go back to 1968. I will tell you then, that was a scary moment compared to where we are now in 2016, 2017. That was really paranoia. A real edge was in the air, and you had people being assassinated, and you had riots, and it was that, she says, was, I mean, I was four, but she says that was scary. This is just a lot of people screaming at each other. Mm-hmm. And this notion of creating narratives is something that is, I don't know, keeps me invested mm-hmm. in the media and watching how this whole thing is going to turn out. It really has, in the last couple of months, reached a fever pitch of hysteria that I don't see how anybody can defend.
Right.
But
can they sustain it, or, and if not,
they haven't. It's not sustained.
What's the button? Like, where's the reset button to?
Well, I thought the reset button was going to be a year after the election. I thought the reset button was going to happen, and it just got worse. And I see it because I live with it. I live with someone who has, I believe, Trump derangement syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I've told him this many times. We get into it back and forth. I really do. I see it.
It's okay. We're going to have him on next. So, you know, equal time. It's the one thing that a small L libertarian organization
does. I am. No. But I do. But I do see it. And I do see it in a knee-jerk reaction to a lot of my liberal friends. When I'll say something that I think is semi-logical mm-hmm. and or I'll say some, well, no, it's not even that I'm defending Trump. I'm just not agreeing with them and clawing my face off in anguish along with them. And when I don't do that.
So you don't believe he's a Russian, that he's the Lawrence Harvey character from The Manchurian Candidate?
No, we're
one phone call away from, you know, Moscow taking over. The one work of yours, and actually of that broader period that seems to really speak to millennials for reasons that escape me, is American Psycho. Probably more the movie than the novel, because I suspect not as many have read the novel. That had such a scandalous opening, or rather a scandalous publication history. It was such a flashpoint. The movie came out, it was seen as, you know, problematic. It was a social problem. It was something we needed to do something about this. Now it is on. It seems if you have even a basic cable package, that is playing somewhere, somehow, sometime for, you know, 24 hours a day. What does your millennial friend think about that? Do they like that? What are they seeing in that? And what do you think the longer term message of that is?
Well, I don't know. I think as the as the writer, which has written all of these books, and I pay attention to what's going on with them, I actually think Less Than Zero, to a strange degree, and it's also being remade as a Hulu series right now, and with people who are actually 21 and 18 and 19, and staying
this,
very true.
This, by the way, is a sidelight of what's great about older movies about kids is that there were always, like, you mentioned Carrie.
Yeah.
John Travolta was like 45.
And
it was Greece took place on a planet where you start high school when you turn 30, it seems.
No, I know. But of course, American Psycho is the most famous book and it sold the most copies, so I'm not, you know. But, I don't know. I don't know. I know there was a lot of referencing of American Psycho in, after the election, there was a lot of Donald Trump, American Psycho stuff going on.
He is Patrick Bateman become president.
Right. And he is mentioned a lot in the book, which was written in the late 80s, because so many people I knew when I was doing my initial research with the Wall Street guys loved him. They loved The Art of the Deal. They loved Trump. He was an aspirational figure. You know, I guess, I don't care, first of all, what they feel about it in terms of, I don't know. I mean, I think that, obviously, there's something about this book and this character that has kept resonating. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was such a strange, personal, experimental novel that I thought, okay, 15,000 copies.
19,000 copies, and I'll write something more commercial for my publisher because I'd be so grateful they're going to publish this novel. And for some bizarre reason that the writer cannot control, it has just kept resonating throughout the decades. And I guess it must be because it is in many ways can be seen as an anti-rich, anti-1% narrative. Certainly it can be read that way, even though I saw it as a personal novel about my own demons having to become an adult and my fighting against that. I did not want to become a man, and certainly did not want to become a man within a society that values this, this, and this, which is money, 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 and status.
And
status.
Heterosexuality in a particular way. I mean, how much does your changing or your evolving statements, I mean, this is the first time we've met. I don't know you at all except through your work and through reading interviews, but it also seems Patrick Bateman, if you're going to be a master of the universe, part of that is being heterosexual. And that seems to be part of the issue there. Right?
But American Psycho is about that moment when the dandification of the American male was happening. And it was happening with... what I saw happening during that decade was straight young male society was aping the attitudes of gay society. They were getting really into shape. They were getting tan. They were getting their hair cut a certain way. They were inordinately interested in fashion.
Your eyebrows tweezed.
All of this
stuff. Wearing hair care products.
Right. Yeah. And that was kind of the spark for American Psycho and for detailing Patrick Bateman's ridiculous routines and his obsession with himself, because I saw that happening. And that became part of the fabric of that novel. Not necessarily because I was gay. I never really was interested in writing about whether I was gay or not. It always seemed like a very boring part of my life to some degree or another. And I always felt that I was in the glass closet. I never was someone who said I was straight. I never said I had girlfriends. I just avoided the question more or less, or played with it, or evaded it. Up until about the late 90s, early 2000s, when I just said, I'm just tired, I don't care anymore. And I also felt that the reputation that I had was kind of, in a weird way, solidified. It wasn't going to be, this wasn't going to change it in a way that I genuinely felt it would have changed it in 1985. I definitely think there were gay fiction sections in bookstores, and writers were definitely relegated to the gay bin rather than just the total bin.
And you didn't want to be next to Ruby Fruit Jungle, that's what I'm hearing.
Or David Levitt, or whoever the big gay writers were of that moment. And so someone once told me, I mean, American Psycho is like the gayest book ever written. And I said, it is pretty gay because Patrick Bateman's so fucking gay. But now, oddly enough, it's not looked at that way.
Yeah.
It's looked at as, oh, this is what you do. And I cannot tell you how many, email or fan stuff about how I taught young men to shave. Because Patrick Bateman has a very, wash the face, keep it wet, put a moisturizer on, and then put a cream, never a foam, always a cream over the moisturizer. Use strokes that go down and then do up. And it was like, I was parroting shit I was reading in Esquire on GQ, thought, this would be hilarious in a novel. Let's put this in a novel. Yeah. And to me, and then, that it takes on a life of its own.
You mentioned Less Than Zero, and in a lot of ways that is, this is true of a lot of writers or creators that their first big work, the DNA is there and everything that you're going to do is in there to a certain degree. What is it about that book that you think persists? Or is it partly that we, at the time that came out, that's something that if you go to an elite private school, you are beyond scarcity. Like you just don't have to think about money. You go to Bennington, you're not even pressured enough where you've got to go to a real Ivy League school. You're okay. You're post scarcity. Everything's going to be okay. And that produces in the characters a aimlessness and a lack of meaning, and even the will, it seems to kind of create existentially meaning from day to day. Is part of the enduring appeal of that is that the rest of society is kind of caught up to that. There's obviously a lot of bad shit in America, but by and large, people, we're free to do whatever we want, which is kind of oftentimes a terrifying apparition.
It's short.
Okay.
It's short, and it's very easy to read. I don't think a chapter is more than two or three paragraphs. and it goes down super, super easy. That is what my guess is after all. And I think the other thing about it is that it is kind of the first book I realize now that the kids were as bad as the parents. In most adolescent fiction, the adolescents are victims. They're victims of older people and their corruption. And Lesson Zero says, no, these kids are kind of as bad as their parents are. And there was something about reading a book where young people were openly aping the attitudes and the lifestyles of these parents that I think was kind of a kick to people, kind of fantasy that that young people really thought was cool. Whereas I wasn't thinking about that at all while writing the book, but really the takeaway the first 5 or 6 years, and still, is that young people read that book and thought, oh, fucking how cool Beverly Hills, how cool it would be to move to LA and to be in that crowd and be in a Mercedes at night snorting a line while having a drink at Spago and all of this stuff. Even, you know, and that's true. I get it. There was, when I got fan letters, actual letters, if people can remember a time where I got fan letters from like everywhere from Indiana to the UK to New Delhi, kids in New Delhi who had read it, who said, this is the coolest book. I want to go to, you know, it seems like such an amazing lifestyle to live. Now, of course, half the people did get it, that it was, you know, kind of my ennui, my adolescent ennui. In many ways, I look at it as a work of juvenilia. It's very hard for me to open that book now without seeing the 18, 19-year-old kind of putting this book together in a very earnest fashion. LA is very bad, and there are very bad people here. But I think what saves the book is that I implicate the narrator. The narrator is just as bad as everyone else. He's not really that judgmental. He kind of like gets squirmy when he wants to know how old the girl they're going to gang rape is. And she's not quite 13, but she's 11. And that's like a moment for him in a way. That's like the only kind of moral. And so I think there's an honesty to that. There wasn't some sort of like moralizing judgment going on explicitly in that book, though of course it's probably there everywhere if you want to see it. And so I think that is part of the appeal of why the book still has readers 30 years later or 25 years later, whatever.
Kardashian West lobbied the president on Ms. Johnson's behalf, and yesterday he commuted her sentence, citing her good behavior and rehabilitation.
I have to say, I never get starstruck. I was starstruck over the Oval Office.
Yeah.
One of the things in preparing for this interview and listening to some of your recent podcasts and other things, I was thinking about Lesson Zero, and you know, in a way, the Kardashians, or Kim Kardashian, is kind of a character out of that book, you know, two or three generations removed. And you have talked in a recent podcast, you talked about how she is actually also, you know, and she's famous for being famous. She is an incredibly effective communicator of things like criminal justice reform with Donald Trump. She has gone there. She actually got people sprung from jail. I mean, this is something that, you know, Angela Merkel should have talked with Kim Kardashian before she came to talk with Donald Trump if she wanted to get some money for Germany or something. Talk a little bit about the ways in which somebody like a Kim Kardashian is kind of the, you know, Lesson Zero, 3 or 4.0, but it's a different story now because she's not, she's coming out of that milieu, but seems to be pretty earnest and also seems to be making a positive difference in the world.
Well, you know, when you've based your career on a sex tape that was probably, many lawyers are probably involved with in terms of getting it leaked out.
Right.
It was probably wrangled
over. It did not appear by accident.
Right. Yeah. Okay. You have someone who gets it. And I wrote about the Kardashians in about, I think it was 2010 for Playboy. I wrote a piece about how there is a kind of post-empire celebrity. A celebrity that says fuck you to the propriety that celebrity is supposed to have. The behaved celebrity who is, oh shucks, I'm just a humble actor and I'm just... it talks about a certain celebrity who understands how media works and uses it to their advantage. I've met Kim Kardashian a couple of times. she is not what she appears to be. There's a lot of calculation, and there is, it's a performative life in a way that is lived in, for us. In terms of what it's lived out in Calabasas, it's much more naturalistic, and it's much more like, oh, let's see if we can do this to make this happen. So, you know, I see her as being extremely smart in terms of being a businesswoman, in terms of building this empire, of course, along with Kris Kardashian, her mother, and also just being able to read the mood of the public for her benefit. And that is something, for example, a lot of people who are, for example, complaining about Trump, that he's orange Hitler, that he's evil, just don't get. And I don't particularly think Kim Kardashian or Kanye, I mean, I know they say they like Trump and all that. I don't know how much about policy they really care about. I think there's something about Trump's dragon energy that appeals to Kanye, and I think there's something that Kim located that she could use from Trump. And so she just went and made it happen, like she's made everything else happen. If celebrities would just calm the fuck down, believe me, Trump will take your call. You want something done, you want to fix something, there's something going on. You know, I really do believe that if you called him, because he's so enthralled to celebrity, that a lot of these celebrities who are screaming about him and screaming about policy and everything, he'd have a sit down with them and we talk it out, and who knows, he might be swayed by celebrity. And I think that that is, there were an unfortunate moment where the hysteria about him is at such a fever pitch that people don't realize that there might be a pathway of communication.
At the end of the day, he heard me out. We got the job done.
You mentioned post-empire. What was the empire?
The empire was roughly from post end of World War II, when we were at the height of our prosperousness and education, and the boomer generation became the best educated, financially, you know, well-off generation. And that was the empire. And empire art was a reflection of that. It was kind of a reflection of propriety, how great we are, how cool we are. Even when we're talking about our own faults and our own flaws, there still was a kind of empire glamorousness to it. And then in post-empire, that seemed to be falling away.
What ended the empire?
What ended the empire? I think 9/11 ended the empire, and it limped along for a few more years. I think Obama helped end the empire.
And
the
Obama. How did he end the empire?
Well, the shock of Obama just being a black man entering into the White House was a big turning point in terms of how people saw the world and how they saw how the American empire, which they thought was working in a certain way, could actually allow this to happen. A big shock to the system. Much as I suppose Trump in a different way, a post-empire president, did. And I do think that there was a desire among people who couldn't deal with the propriety of a kind of behavior. You saw it in the arts first, and I saw it all over the place beginning after the Obama election. In 2009, 2010, reality TV certainly, really, the Kardashians helped bring this into play. And you saw it with artists as disparate as Eminem, with the way he would record an autobiographical album about his divorce and ending with him murdering his wife. And you compared it to like Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, where it's a very elegant, very mournful, very stylish piece of music, or Bruce Springsteen with Tunnel of Love. And you just started to notice that the albums that were being made and the expression was much more, I do not give a shit. I don't give a shit. This is me. I think the Charlie Sheen meltdown was one of those pivotal moments where we saw a celebrity in full meltdown. I do not care, guys. Follow me around. And you saw it in like, I saw it in a lot of disparate places during 2010, 2011, 2012. And then there was a pushback on it. And corporate culture began putting this back into the bottle. It didn't want to allow it for it anymore. And corporate culture won. The post-empire attitude that you saw in a lot of artists just was considered, I don't know, too much. So it was too much of a disruptor.
Roseanne is an example of this then, of, you know, she gets the reboot, but she's not domesticated again, so she gets bounced.
Right. Well, I mean, Roseanne is a victim of corporate culture, just the way that James Gunn is, just the way that a lot of people are right now. To some degree or another. Many men who got sucked up into the tidal wave of Me Too were just boors. They were just dicks. You know, they didn't do anything illegal necessarily. They were just assholes. So I don't know. I think that corporate culture in a way is definitely, is a form of censorship, and it's a form of shutting down the artist and shutting down free speech. And that's where we are right now.
And, but you're also, I mean, when you say corporate culture, you're not, again, this isn't from the Young Turks perspective that, you know, corporations are evil because they're capitalistic, et cetera.
You're talking about free expression. Yeah. That's what I'm, and I'm talking about it from an artist's standpoint. I don't think it really bothers people who aren't, who don't depend on expressing themselves as a living. Right. That 2018 has been really horrible in that way, in terms of seeing people punished for a tweet or for something they said 8 years ago that was a joke, and then being punished and banished for it is not a particularly teachable moment right now. It's just like, you know,
Do you see a need for a different type of discourse or a resetting of the
of
table?
Course.
Or is it okay? So then, what goes into that?
Well, look, I think that what should have happened with Roseanne Barr is that ABC should have immediately said, "We're running a live program on ABC Friday night at 8 o'clock, where we're having Roseanne Barr, we're having Valerie Jarrett, we're having the cast of Roseanne, we're having some." Black activists.
Yeah, I was going to say throw in some of the chorus from Hamilton.
Well, yeah, sure, you do that. And let's have a talk about what happened on Monday when this tweet came out. Let's have a moment where we're all going to have a conversation. First of all, the ratings for that would have been astronomical. They would have been huge. And whatever ad time you could have sold would have been just, you know, and that would have been...
You could have even been selling ads during that hour.
Yeah. And you could have had a real moment of, let's talk about this, instead of just firing someone.
Why wouldn't something like that happen? Is it a failure of vision, or is it a failure of nerve, or it doesn't serve corporate
interests? It gets too complicated, and people don't like that, because it touches on very complicated realities about humor, about race, about privileged, about free expression. And it's just too much to take, I think. I think people just can't deal. It's turned into a very black and white world right now. Or red and orange, or Laurel and Yanni, whatever you want to call it. I didn't mean to make a race thing out of the black and white. But it really has become this thing where the dialogue isn't happening in the way that it should. And I think it was perfectly expressed in what happened with Mark Duplass, where he said it's time for us to reach across the aisle and listen to the other side. And, you know, he used Ben Shapiro as an example of the person we should listen to. And, of course, he got excoriated for it, Mark Duplass. I think the Mark Duplass apology is one of the most depressing things that happened this year. And him deleting that tweet is one of the most important. How can someone who you really like and you had a good time with, and he's one of the good ones over there, whatever Mark Duplass said, 48 hours later be a racist, homophobic, piece of shit, jerk, a disaster? It's like, I mean, that was, and I've known Mark. I had Mark on my podcast, and I thought, really? This is where the left is? This is where the resistance is? This is where the Hollywood Silver Lake hipster attitude is? That you're really this much?
But that's the right, you know, and these are bad terms because they really don't.
No, happen. I know.
Yeah,
it is
but right. Then the right is the reason why James Gunn got fired, because a bunch of people there were like, hey, look at this.
No. Corporate culture is the reason why James Gunn got fired. Not Mike Cernovich and not like, no. Yeah. It is corporate culture. Got ABC, got Roseanne Barr fired. No, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the left. It wasn't the right. It was corporate culture. All arrows go back to corporate culture in terms of this kind of firing. And that's true with all of the men who were, you know, fired from the Me Too movement. It's just that we're not taking it case by case by case and looking at it. And I do think now, with Chris Hardwick giving his show back, I think there's a pushback on this kind of, and I think the, whatever, 500,000 names for the petition to rehire James Gunn. I think there is a real pushback on this, that we cannot just be judge and jury in an hour after something happens and people are just banished. I think there was kind of a shock at first, but I think there's a natural inclination, a human inclination now to say, maybe this isn't really the way to do it. This isn't the way to have the conversation, and we got to have it in a different way.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there, and we're going to point people to Bret Easton Ellis's podcast on Patreon. You should look it up because that's a place where you'll be having conversations, right? Not, hour-long or two-hour-long show trials.
Correct.
Okay. So well, that's one place. And you also have a book coming out next year?
Yeah, it's being edited right now. It'll be published by Knopf, and we don't even really know what the title is.
Do you know what it's about?
It's about corporate culture.
It is about
a nonfiction book about corporate culture and freedom of speech, and about how the silencing of artists.
Okay, that sounds like a theme that will stay fresh at least for another 6 months.
Yeah.
So, if not another six centuries. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.